you know, today is December 5th. This is the first interview with Mary Beth Plain. We're here at her home in Madison. And my name is Troy Reeves, and I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. And I'm just jotting down here on my notes so I can remember what day this is and who I'm interviewing. So Mary Beth, usually what we do is we try to get a little bit of a context about your life before we get to your time at UW-Madison.
Okay.
So if you wouldn't mind, talk a little bit about your childhood, sort of whatever jumps out, basically the where you grew up, mm-hmm. what your parents did, a little brief biography of your early years.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. I was born in Milwaukee, but only spent the first year of my life there. My dad was in school at Marquette. In law school, and he and my mom had met each other as freshmen at Marquette. She was a journalism major and worked as an editor after she graduated while he was in the service. And he was in ROTC and went to the Pacific during World War II and was a captain of an LCT over there. And then came back, graduated from law school, and when he graduated, we moved to Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, where he grew up. And so that's where I grew up too. I'm the oldest of seven. My sister is the second oldest, and then there were five. I have five brothers after that. Fond du Lac is a small town to grow up in, but a nice one. You know, we had a comfortable life, mm-hmm. you know, with my dad being an attorney. I never felt like we were affluent, which we weren't, but we had what we needed and we were very comfortable. I went to parochial schools, St. Joseph's School, and then to St. Mary Springs Academy, graduated from there in 1964. Liked sports, played softball on, you know, on a league, and was in Girl Scouts. That was a big part of my youth, you know, for many years, all the way through high school. Okay. And probably my biggest mentor was my Girl Scout leader at that time.
Okay.
Then I went to Mount Mary College and graduated from there in 1968 with a degree in sociology. Became a social worker in Milwaukee County, and was there for, I don't know, around two plus years. And Peter and I got married in 1969, and he transferred schools from Chicago. He was at Loyola University to UWM, and then again transferred to Superior, UW-Superior, so we moved up there, and I became a social worker up there, protective services social worker, child welfare. Mm. And we were there for a couple of years till he graduated. And then we moved to Green Bay, Wisconsin, and where he got a teaching job. And I was a social worker in protective services again. And let's see, we were there for a couple of years. And then we moved here to Madison in 1974. I'm pretty sure it was the year Nixon resigned. Mm. We were in Europe that summer, and came back, and I resigned my job. He resigned his, and he came down here and was a teacher, and I applied to graduate school, to the School of Social Work.
Okay.
And took a while, but I got in.
Just a couple of follow-ups from your early years. Was education something, or getting an education, a good education, something that your parents
valued?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Okay. They totally expected me to go to college. They were both graduates of Marquette, and they were first-generation college graduates. Their parents hadn't gone to school.
Okay. And why did you choose Mount Mary?
It's going back. I took tours of, I was pretty much limited to Catholic colleges because of my family preferences. And so we toured the Catholic colleges in Milwaukee. I didn't really want to go that much further than that. I'm not that adventurous. Okay. And the tour at Mount Mary seemed to be, it just helped me make up my mind that that's where I wanted to be.
Okay.
So I was pretty active there in sports. I played a lot of sports in student government. I was the student government president there.
Okay. That period was like 60, basically maybe fall of 64 through 68.
Mm-hmm.
Vietnam War was starting to become an issue on campuses around the country. What about on Mount Mary?
At Mount Mary, there wasn't a lot of activity in terms of the war protesting. I remember being active politically in the church because there was a lot of, you know, Vatican II was coming along in there, and we were trying to push more things that were more appropriate for the laity. You know, rather than having Mass in Latin and stuff like that. But the other thing that, I mean, I was active. I marched with Father Grappi. There was open housing marches, you know, during that time. And we got a couple of us got pretty active in that. Mostly I did it by myself, but I went down with a couple of other people sometimes. But that was the most political, you know. That the year I graduated was more when Milwaukee started having demonstrations against the Vietnam War.
Okay.
You know, in that summer.
Did you, when you marched with Father Grappi, did you participate in any of the march when he marched here in Madison? Or was it in the
Yeah, war? Well, that was, after I started working as a social worker, there were demonstrations here in Madison for welfare rights. And we drove, we had a big parade in our cars from Milwaukee, going like 40 miles an hour, as slow as you could go on the freeway, and then went to the Capitol and demonstrated for better welfare benefits and things like that. That must have been in 1969 and 70. I had in Milwaukee there, I had a Girl Scout troop downtown in the neighborhood down below the Allen Brady Clock. Geez, what was that? Fourth and I can't remember what that is. It was a Hispanic neighborhood, and so I was. That was kind of nice. I had a Girl Scout troop in Superior and in Green Bay too.
Okay.
When I was there. No kid. We didn't have any kids, but, you know, I just, you know, I wanted to give back some of the good stuff I had.
Right.
Yeah.
Trying to pay that mentorship.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you said you moved to Madison in 74. You were in Europe before you, did you take a vacation?
Yeah, we took the summer.
Okay.
And went to Europe.
So you resigned and then took the summer?
Well, it sort of was like that, yeah.
Okay. What, not that it has anything to do with UW-Madison, but having gone to Europe, I always like to ask what sort of stood out in your mind about the traveling.
We biked all summer and camped, and it was just amazing. We met very interesting people, had, you know, great stories to tell, and corresponded with some of them for years afterwards, and just had some really fine, wonderful experiences. You know, biking up the Alps was an incredible thing. They have good grades in their roads. They know how to do. They know how to build roads that you don't have to walk your bike up. Mm. You know, when you go up mountains in England, you walk your bike. I mean, I had to, but in the Alps, it was. Of course, I was in better shape by then, but the grade of the roads was a lot better.
Okay. So had you decided before you moved to Europe, or moved,
went
before
to
you
to
went
move?
To Europe?
No.
Okay.
No, I came back and went to work. Peter had decided he wasn't going to go back to work, but then in the fall he got a job down here, and so I kept working for a little while and then moved down here and started applying to school.
And where did Peter work? What job?
He was a middle school teacher at Marquette Middle School, which is now George O'Keefe High School. And he was an elementary or middle school teacher from then here in Madison until June of 2011 when he retired.
So fall of 74 mm-hmm. to spring of 2011.
Right. Yeah.
Was that all at Marquette or was that...
Oh, no. He was at Marquette and let's see, where else did he teach? He taught at Hamilton. Which wasn't Hamilton at the time, but it is now, and Tolkien grade school. And then after that, he went to Cherokee, and then he was spent the last, oh, I don't know, I would say at least 15, if not 20 years at Crestwood.
Okay. Had you seen much of Madison before you moved here?
No, not at all. I was hardly ever here. Other than the demonstrations that I did and maybe some student government activities that we did, coming to observe the legislature and things like that. But no, I'd never been here.
Where did you live?
When you right before
came?
We came?
Yeah. Or no, when you came here, where mm-hmm. did you get an apartment, did you get a house?
Oh, we bunked with some friends for a couple of weeks and then got an apartment on the north side of town right next to Mendota School. And it wasn't an apartment, actually. It was a two-unit. And subsequently ended up buying that two-unit from the owner and lived there for quite a few years. Moved here to Island Drive in the fall of 1989. So we've been
89.
Yeah, so we've been here since then. It's a lot closer to Crestwood. And I didn't have to drive through the Isthmus to get to work either. And I could bike, actually, when I wanted to, but I didn't do that as much as I should have.
So about the first decade and a half on the north side?
Yep.
Okay. And then since then here?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
And... So why did you decide to apply for graduate school?
I did?
Yeah.
Well, when I was a social worker, I was working with families that were having major issues and really didn't feel like I had the theoretical background to be able to think about it in a way that was more global than just one family at a time. And also didn't feel like I really had learned quite enough to even work with individual families one at a time. You know, I felt like there was more to know. And so I started taking some classes at Extension when I was in Superior. And in Eau Claire, actually, I drove down to Eau Claire to take those. And so I started doing some of that. And then when we moved to Madison, I built on that. It took me a while to get into graduate school because my undergraduate years were full of lots of other activities other than academic. I think I probably never could get into graduate school now because of my grade point average. But I did, and you know, wanted to get a master's degree, which I did. And it was interesting because we were learning, the people who wrote the textbooks that we were learning from were faculty here. You know, Alan Pincus and Ann Minahan were, right in the forefront of thinking of how social work was to be done or, you know, the theoretical part of it. I never had either one of them as a professor, but knew them and learned from their work.
Mm-hmm. When you came into graduate school here, was your cohort... I mean, age-wise, were you on the upper end of it?
Oh, yeah. I had 7 years of work experience compared to other people. There were some who had, work experience in addition to me, but I was probably one of the older master's degree students.
Upon reflection, how do you feel how did you feel, or how can you describe... being older than the rest of the cohort, how do you think that affected your experience?
Oh, I felt like it made it a lot easier to be there because I had had experience in what we were learning about, and so I could take some of the theory behind what people were talking about and apply it to things that I knew or things that I wished we could do or something like that. Mm-hmm. It was learning a new language, you know, in terms of how to think about social work and broadening my look at social work, because it really added on the community approach and community work in addition to the one-on-one kind of stuff that I had been doing, or, you know, one-on-one collaboration with people, say, in the school district, being a county social worker. Mm-hmm. You know, I had to work with the school people and public health people, you know, public health nurses and things like that, but hadn't really done a whole lot of thinking about, you know, systems. You know, it was just really, how do I help this kid, or how do I work with this family and things like that. And so it had helped me broaden that.
So again, it's the idea of sort of thinking about things more globally.
Yep.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that there was some theory behind it and reasons for doing, reasons for doing certain actions or taking certain actions and so forth.
Just at least one more thing about the cohort of people. Not that graduate school is necessarily a place to make friends, do you feel like you got along well with your cohort? Were there people in your cohort that you continue to have a either professional or personal relationship with?
There's people that were in my cohort that I know I'm not good friends with, but I run into them here in town or... Mm-hmm. You know, maybe see them on Facebook or something, but not really. They're not really good friends of mine.
Okay. So, and in terms of professional relationships, none came from that cohort either?
No.
Okay.
Mainly because of what I did after I graduated, probably. Okay. You know, because there's a number of them that work in town. It's just that I don't cross paths with them because of the path that I took after I graduated.
So where, I think I know, but I asked directly so you can mm-hmm. you can answer it. Where were most of your classes held?
Oh, in the School of Social Work, the old School of Social Work on Henry Mall.
Okay.
You know, I mean, this is for my master's degree. That's what I'm talking about.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, it was Wisconsin High School at one time.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure. I don't know. Yeah. I'm pretty sure it was. But
yeah, because that and then that building's sure. been redone. And there's
they tore the whole thing
right.
down. It was the most beautiful mall in the world.
Do you need to get that?
I don't think so.
Okay.
It was the most beautiful mall. You know, Henry Mall was. They had a gardener. You know, this was in the days when money actually was. There was some money mm-hmm. to pay people to do things, and the gardener there, whose name is escaping me. Did a really nice job of making that mall look absolutely gorgeous. And then they tore down that building and built they built the genetics building next to it too. And mm-hmm. they tore it all up, and really it's never gotten back to where it was. And the buildings across the way too, the science buildings, mm-hmm. you know, on Henry Mall also. I mean, it's just been total construction ever since. I think that it looks a little bit better. I don't think it's ever going to get back to where it was.
Mm-hmm. And were you working at this time while you were taking classes?
Not in my master's program, no.
Okay.
I went through that pretty fast.
Okay, so financially it wasn't, was it?
Peter was working and we just managed.
And at that point, kids weren't...
We didn't have any kids yet.
Okay. How long did it take you to get through the program?
I don't know, maybe a year and a half.
Okay.
At the most. I think I had placements for three semesters. Two semesters I was in, so maybe it was 2 years. It could have been two. I had a placement at the guidance clinic in Beloit, working with, what was the name of it? It was a treatment program for families out of Mendota. Marianne Fall was the leader of it, and it was a specific behavioral management approach to work with families. I just can't remember. Home and Community Treatment, I think, is what it was called. Okay. And then I had a placement for the other placement that I had was at Dane County Social Services and their adult foster care unit.
Okay. I only have a master's degree, but for my master's degree, I had to write a thesis.
Yeah, I didn't have to do that.
Okay.
I can't remember why. So I had to write something. I remember writing something, but I don't even know what it was.
Okay, but not a major.
No, it wasn't a major.
Was there, again, for my graduate degree in history, you know, my focus was in U.S. history, you know, 20th century U.S. history. Mm-hmm. Getting a master's in social work, was there an emphasis in some aspect or sub-aspect?
Boy, thinking back, I just can't remember.
Okay.
You know, I took child welfare and supervision, and, you know, I just wanted to get as many practical courses as I could in terms of working with families. I really actually was planning on going back to county social work or something like that.
Okay. Anything else you can think of that you want to talk about that 2-year period all those years ago in
it's
graduate
hard
school?
Hard to remember back.
Well, here you said that I will ask one more thing. You said that some of the folks who wrote the textbooks you didn't take classes from.
Right.
But, do you recall the professors who stood out either for one reason or another of the classes that you did take?
Well, Al Kadushin was like Mr. Or Professor Social Work in many ways, and the definitive person in terms of social work supervision and child welfare, and he was a pretty good mentor to me. I worked for... I took a course with John Flanagan, and... After I got done taking that course, he asked me if I would come work for him and encouraged me to go into the PhD program. And so I spent the summer after I graduated thinking about that, you know, about whether or not I wanted to actually do that.
Mm-hmm.
And decided to do it. And then John hired me as a teaching assistant. For a couple years.
Okay.
And, you know, the first couple years of my PhD program.
And was the... And you started the PhD and that was in social work?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Social welfare is
social
what
it's welfare.
Called.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, well, and it was matched up with sociology. I took a lot of social classes.
So then your idea of getting back into...
Well, I applied for a job, and actually was offered a job with Dane County, and for some reason, I just decided I'd rather go on to school. You know, I think it was exciting thinking about working on the theoretical, you know, academic end of things. And if I went back to the county, I would be doing pretty much the same thing as I had been doing before. You know, and so, you know, this sounded like at least something to explore and be more interested in, so I did that. Then I was a PhD student for 10 years. It took a long time. That's when I had my kids.
Okay.
That's when we had kids. Both of our kids were born while I was in the PhD program.
So you got your master's, and then that next... There wasn't much of a gap before you started.
No, there was
PhD.
The summer. You know, we took the summer and we went canoeing and camping and had a nice summer. And then Peter went back to school and, you know, teaching. And I mm-hmm. went back to school.
So what sort of work were you doing for you were a teaching assistant for?
Yeah, five, right, for his research methods class.
Did that involve actual teaching or...?
Mostly consulting with the students on their individual projects, reading okay. papers. That's mainly what it was.
Did you grade those papers or did you give some just sort of rough idea that then...
No, I think I graded them. Okay. It's hard to remember way back then. I think I might have taught a class or two also, but...
Uh, Did you have your children as you were a TA, or was that after?
I don't know. I was a TA for a while, and then I got a traineeship.
Traineeship,
okay. Right. And Jack Lefkowitz was in charge of that. And it was really learning about evaluation and program evaluation. And I had some work to do with that. And so I had that for maybe 3 years. That's probably when I had the kids. I can't remember. Then there were probably a couple of years in there when I... Oh, no, and then... Oh, wow. Yeah, then after my course... I had Katie while I was still in class, and that was in 1978. Okay. And so I had one more semester of classes after she was born, I think, or two, something like that. And then I was a dissertator, and dissertated for several years. During that time, I had a job with... Betty Tuning and Sandy Danziger, they were both professors here, that did some work for the state, some program evaluation, and that had to do with, one of them had to do with foster care. One of the grants had to do with family planning services.
Okay. So program evaluation. So you were working with these professors to, you'd go in and take a look at how these programs were doing things, and then...
Yeah, it was a lot of survey work, phone survey work, you know, finding out how people did things and stuff like that. And then some articles came out of it that they were in charge of and I helped write, but I don't think they were ever published.
Okay.
The family planning was not supposed to be an article, it was a report. And so that was a published report for the state. And then after that, I worked for, this is a few years, you know, I worked for Dr. Patricia Cotley, and we evaluated the Home and Community Treatment Program. And that was a program evaluation. And what came out of that was a book that Pat wrote and never published. She was in her late 80s when I was working for her. She was a very independent soul, got funding, her own grant funding, and so through the state to do this program evaluation, and there were some reports that came out of it also for the state. So I worked for her for a number of years, and ended, my job with her ended the month before Daniel was born, and he was born in 83. And I don't think I worked after that. For a couple of years, I mainly was a mom and paid my tuition for being a dissertator, but didn't work really hard at being a dissertator. And then for about a year or two, and then I finished.
Okay. So then finished in around 86?
Yeah, right.
What was your, I know it's here in your CV, but what was your dissertation topic?
My dissertation topic was a look at... family planning programs. I collected my own data about family planning programs across the state of Wisconsin and asked them certain questions about their program and tried to figure out if a program that was conducive to access by teens was related at all to county birth rates and county characteristics. And so I used some data that the state had collected on birth rates, and you know, I worked with the Center for Demography and got information from them. Collected my own data on programs and put that all together and did the analysis and wrote it up.
And what did you find out?
Boy, that was a long time ago, but there were things that were related, particularly hours. Actually, it was surprising. Who knows if that was really the reason, you know, because the family planning programs were more conducive to letting kids get there, or if it was the characteristics of the counties. I just can't remember.
Okay.
You know, when I, about 4 months before I defended my dissertation, my John Flanagan, who was my major professor, died. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Al-Kadushin took over. He was on my committee already anyway and took over as the chair of my committee. And fortunately, I had one more committee member than I needed on my committee. So I was able to not have to have somebody else, you know, come up and get up to speed on what I was working on.
Were you close to Flanagan? I mean,
pretty. I mean, he was kind of an odd duck. His major work was about the prison system, and so he studied the Illinois prison system more than he did study anything else, and you know, interviewed people like Richard Speck. I don't know if you ever heard of him, but he was a serial killer.
Okay.
And, you know, he, in some ways, I felt like, you know, he probably felt like he had something in common with these people because he liked to break rules. Not any rules that were illegal,
right.
But, you know, he just liked to do things differently. You know, and he was a smoker, and I think he was defiant that wasn't going to do anything, and that's actually why he died, is because he ended up with cancer. But yeah, we got along pretty well. We didn't do a lot socially or anything, but mm-hmm. you know, we'd have lunch and I spent time with his family a little bit. Peter and I did before our kids were born.
Okay, so it sounds like though having that extra person on the committee helped to sort of lessen the possible turmoil or tumult that
right.
could have been caused.
Yeah.
By
well, the reason that there was an extra person on there was because of the turmoil at the beginning. Because one of the people on my committee, I didn't feel like I ever got what he was about.
Okay.
And so I said, I really need somebody else besides this person on my committee. And so we got Betty Thompson from Demography, which was the saving grace because she totally understood what it was that I was trying to do. And, you know, helped me actually put it together. Or guided me. She really didn't help me put it together, but she guided me in terms of what I needed to do.
Okay.
You know, these days, at least the PhD candidates that I know go through and they're expected, like in population health, they're expected to write 3 articles that are potentially publishable, and that's their dissertation. That would have been so cool. That's a really great way to start a career,
mm-hmm.
you know, but I had to try and figure this out for myself after I graduated, especially without John around, and, you know, Al wasn't, like, my primary mentor. I really never got that together.
Okay.
You know, with a couple kids and not having a faculty position, it really didn't matter.
So did any part of your dissertation work become published?
No, never. Other than it goes into the Library of Congress.
Right. Right. So when do you... Well, I see here you're a lecturer, at least for a year, or maybe just a semester, in Social Policy 405 and 86.
Right, right.
Is that your first entree into paid...
Well, no, actually, I worked for Cardinal Stuart College. I think I did that probably before I was this lecturer, but I'm not sure. I can't remember.
And I was actually asking it in terms of UW-Madison.
Oh, right. Yes, that was.
Okay. You must have either have... were in the process of getting your degree or PhD or had gotten it by that point.
Yeah, I think it was right after I got it.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Was that just
was
a lecturer adjunct position?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that the first class that you had taught?
Yep.
From, you know, beginning to end, all yours?
Yeah.
It was a while ago, but what are your memories of?
Well, actually, it wasn't the whole class because they had a faculty who had to quit teaching partway through the semester. So I came in and heard her first 2 classes or something, and then I took over the class.
Oh, wow.
You know, it was social policy. I really don't remember a whole lot about it. She had people who, you know, she invited in a lot mm-hmm. of times in social policy. You do that. You have people from the state that come in or, you know, the government that come in and talk. And I'm sure that she and I talked about what readings to have and stuff like that after she left. I'm sure I had to pick out readings, and I'm sure we discussed them, but I don't remember much about it.
So it must not have been that huge a deal if it didn't...
No.
Okay.
I had had some really good social policy teachers. I mean, Sheldon Danziger is a brilliant professor who was in the School of Social Work at the time when I was there, and helped me learn to think about social policy in a way that I had never thought about it before. You know, in terms of the whole country. Mm-hmm. You know, if something happens nationally, this is the impact on it locally. Mm-hmm. You know, like in terms of, you know, I mean, you know, the simplest example is if you cut federal taxes, well, state taxes have to go up, or and the local people actually end up really getting nailed, possibly. Or, you know, like if you lose jobs in this sector, what happens, you know, mm-hmm. community-wide or statewide or nationally in terms of the job market and how you think about all that. Yeah, he was quite good.
So again, thinking globally about things. Mm-hmm. Could you spell his name, last name?
Danziger.
But you'd said that you had taught at Cardinal
yes,
Stritch.
Yes, I've taught for Cardinal Stritch College for a couple of years, actually.
Before. Okay.
I don't know, maybe I could have even been doing that when I was still getting my degree.
Okay.
I wonder. It's possible.
What were you teaching at Cardinal Stritch?
I taught research methods mostly.
Okay.
This was back in the days when computers were relatively easy to understand and people were just learning how to use them in the workplace. I taught some beginning computer classes and an environmental science class, which I totally was unqualified to teach, but it's my passion outside of work.
Okay.
You know, so I think I probably did a pretty good job with that. I did that quite a few times. I taught here in Madison and in Beloit.
And not having a degree in that, how did you get to teach the environmental?
I don't know. They needed somebody. I couldn't find anybody.
Okay. How did you, when you caught, you say you have outside of your vocation, you have a mm-hmm. passion for environmental.
Right.
Where does that come from?
When I grew up, I was outside all the time. I don't know. Did a lot of camping, did a lot of, you know, there was a creek that ran by our house. We were right on the edge of town.
So it looks like the next year, 1987, is you become a senior research specialist.
Right.
So can you explain the...
How that happened?
What you recall the path of.
Okay. Well, I had applied for a job in Minnesota, and they wanted me to come interview for a professor position, and it just didn't seem like that was the right thing to do, to move out of Madison because of our family situation. And so I applied for some jobs here, and with the idea that if I got my foot in the door, you know, in a department, maybe I could advance. And so I was thinking that way right from the beginning, but, you know, with a PhD, usually people don't hire you as a research specialist because it's just not... I mean, I don't do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't do it when I got to where I am now, but or very often anyway. But they interviewed me and hired me, and in the Department of Family Medicine, I got a good reference from the people I had worked for before, and started working for Pat McBride on soft money. It was what was called a Preventive Cardiology Academic Award, and he was the first family physician to get this in the history of the country. And he was interested in preventive cardiology from the primary care point of view and wrote this grant to teach physicians about, and medical students, about preventive cardiology. And so he hired me to help run that grant. And he and Gail Underbakke, who is a nutritionist here in Madison and was working at UW, and I worked on that grant. He and she did the teaching, and I ran the rest of the grant. There were things that he did, like
small research projects that involved medical students. We collected data from physicians asking them what did they need to know about preventive cardiology. What, you know, this was way back when cholesterol was just becoming controversial.
Right.
And so we, you know, did the research and wrote several articles about, you know, about all medical students learning and physicians' needs and learning. And he and Gail put together a nice curriculum for the medical school. And the result of that grant, after 5 years of working on it, we started work, or during the 5 years of working on it, we started working on writing a grant that would take a look at what would happen in a primary care clinic if we had a health educator to work with patients, you know, to reduce their cholesterol, help with hypertension issues, help with diet and exercise and things like that. So we wrote a grant to NIH and that we called the Heart Project. And as a result of writing that grant, we were awarded it. It was a $3 million grant, and it was a 5-year grant to work with, I can't remember how many, maybe 40 clinics, 40 or 44 clinics around the state of Wisconsin, Iowa, and Minnesota. And we had collaborators from those states, too, and from northern Wisconsin. And we went into clinics, you know, 10 clinics in Minnesota, 10 in Iowa, 10 in northern Wisconsin, and 10 around Madison, and it was like a randomized controlled trial of putting either a health educator or training their people to do the work of, you know, of working with patients to see if we could get the system to meet the needs of patients and help them lower their cholesterol and stuff like that. And we learned an awful lot about it, wrote a lot of articles, and then I think Pat decided that research wasn't his passion. It was really working with students and working in preventive cardiology. And he went to he went more into working in preventive cardiology. And Gail went back to working with in nutrition and seeing patients in nutrition. She wrote a cookbook, and I stayed on in the department, and with the help of Bill Houston, who was one of our physicians in Eau Claire. We have campuses in Eau Claire, and at that time we had one in Wausau. We have one in Appleton, and we have an affiliation with Milwaukee. And I was working with all of them. I knew all of them. We were a small department at that time, so we knew each other. He and I identified that it would be really good for the department if we had somebody there who could help people do their research, you know, like the physicians. And so we were looking for the department to support somebody to do the research coordination for the department. There was always already a research director, a physician, but, you know, not somebody who could actually do some of the work for small projects the physicians had. And the department had some small grant money and decided to hire me. Now, all this time, I was working half-time for Pat and Gail. When we wrote the Heart Project, I went from a research specialist to being a scientist, and I was a co-investigator on that grant, on the Heart grant. So, you know, my career was starting to do what I had hoped it would do, you know, like recognize the fact that I had a PhD and, you know, and I was able to do more work, because in the Heart Project, I did a lot of the overall data collection, data management. You know, we had a lot of people who were part of that grant, you know, in waves, and had a lot of data to collect, and so I was in charge of a lot of that and, you know, working on, you know, what analyses we should do, and working with people, you know, in the theoretical part of it. It was really kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
so
part.
as a research specialist early on.
Mm-hmm.
So let me ask it this way. So I think you alluded to it there, if not spoke about it directly, but the differences between being a research specialist and then as you became a co-investigator slash scientist in heart disease. What does that mean in terms of your work specifically on those grants?
I was doing the same work.
Doing the same
work. Sure. Okay. I'm the same person. They had the same needs. I mean, the preventive cardiology grant wasn't as sophisticated as the heart grant. I helped write the theoretical parts of the heart grant. Help decide the data we were going to collect. So it was really a step up because of the work we were doing, you know, the kind of work we were doing. And, doing the grant management was also a lot more complicated because on the preventive cardiology one, I only had myself to deal with. You know, Gail and Pat had their own things and I had mine. And then... under the Heart Project, we had a big staff. We hired people to. It was the days before electronic medical records, so we had to train like maybe 6 or 7 people in each region to, do medical record reviews and stuff. So I had to hire somebody to do the training, and we had to develop the protocols for how to, collect the data, what data we wanted, and how it would fit the theory, and how it would, fit what we were trying to, the data we were trying to collect and stuff like that.
So while this was all going on, the senior research specialist and then the co-investigator for the Heart Project, you were half-time soft money?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You got one grant pretty much right after the other, so I'm guessing there wasn't much.
There wasn't any time in between. Well, there was maybe 3 months in between, and the department bridged me because they knew that it was funded. The next grant was funded.
Okay. So in that first decade or so, there wasn't a lot of worry. I mean, you weren't working full-time, but there wasn't a lot of worry that you were going to lose the position that you
had. Right. I actually didn't think much about it, and it was interesting because when we got the Heart Grant, I came home and I was, of course, excited because it was pretty cool and I figured I could become a scientist then. I told my family and my son, who I don't know, he must have been in 3rd or 4th grade by then, said, "Oh, Mom, now you have a job until I'm like 12 or something like that." So it was like, wow, that's interesting, that he thought that it was a bigger deal than I had been thinking.
Right.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. But, being on soft money does have its pressures. My makeup is such that I don't worry about that kind of stuff as much as a lot of other people do.
Okay.
I've certainly had people working for me who've quit before a grant was over because they were worried about not getting funded again, and so they went looking for more money, a better job someplace else, or another job someplace else that was more secure.
Right.
That's happened.
Maybe one, maybe two more things this time.
Sure.
So when you have the soft money stuff working part-time, were you doing any campus work for academic staff or anything like that?
At that time, I'm trying to think when my academic staff work started. Boy, I'd have to go see if I could figure that out. In the department, yes, in our Department of Family Medicine, my academic staff work started. There were a number of us who were academic staff who were senior. By that time, I'd been there for 8-10 years, and there were other people who had been there for a while. And it's interesting because when you have physicians working with staff, the physicians make decisions and do what they think is right, and they're very smart people. And they sometimes make decisions that an academic staff would know it aren't going to work. And or don't know how much work is involved. "Oh, we'll just do this," they might say. And an academic staff person might say, "Oh, my word, we can't do that." Or, who's going to do this, or how is it going to get done? Because this is going to take this kind of time, or the academic staff is going to have to do the piece of work that they're making decisions about. So many of the committees in our department didn't have an academic staff person on them. So we formed an academic staff committee within our department, completely outside of the university. Now, you have to remember that family medicine people really have a hard time believing they're part of the university, because we're removed, because we're in the medical school, but we're also not even in the medical school. We're in a building on Mills Street next to St. Mary's Hospital that really we never saw a person from the university at all, and occasionally would see somebody from the medical school, you know, and would just go visit the old, that old medical school building that used to be University Hospital, mm-hmm. you know. So we didn't feel a big connection to UW. You know, I never really thought of, I mean, I knew I was an employee of the University of Wisconsin, but didn't really interact with people there. So anyhow, we made our own academic staff committee and met once a month. And wrote a grant, you know, those academic staff professional development grants mm-hmm. you have. Okay, so we wrote a grant, got the department to put up half the money and asked for half the money. And all of us wrote it together and said we wanted to do professional development for our academic staff and some training. And so we did that. And we would get speakers in maybe twice or three times a year. And then we'd have a little money that we could spend to pay them if we needed to. Mm-hmm. We also did some training and tapped into some of the resources of the human services folks at HR mm-hmm. at the university. And, you know, like things like how to work with a difficult person or how to be a good supervisor. We built our own training back in the day. I don't know if you were even here yet when we actually had merit increases. And we built training in because there wasn't good, there wasn't actually any good system for evaluating people. People didn't get reviews. Mm-hmm. So we advocated with our staff and said, you know, you deserve a review. You should have one, especially since the merit system is going to start working. So we did some training in for people as to how to ask for a review, how to get a review. We trained supervisors on how to do a review. And this is all the academic staff doing this. We invited classified staff to be part of it. I mean, we didn't just make it for us. And when we had people coming in, like to give a talk on stress reduction or time management or even financial consulting or something, we'd invite everybody, and faculty would sometimes show up. You know, so that went on. That particular group, we did that for probably 15, 20 years or something like that. No, maybe 15.
Okay.
And when I became, later on in my career, when I became more management, I backed off of that because I felt like the academic staff group didn't need a manager there. They shouldn't have a manager there mm-hmm. because they can't be free to mm-hmm. say what they want.
Right.
You know, but anyhow, so that's how we started. We started a mentoring program. So we had group mentoring and individual mentoring within our department for each other. And then we decided that, you know, that's really probably not the best thing to do, is to have our department people mentoring. And so we started looking around, and that's when I found that the university was developing an academic staff mentoring program. And I'm forgetting her name. Anne
Wallace.
Yeah. And Shard Tortorici mm-hmm. and Jean Bielman were all part of that. And they had been working on it for about a year. And they heard about our program and called us and said, would you come over and work with us and let us know what you've been doing? So then I became active on that academic staff mentoring program for the university as a representative from our department. And I was on that for, I don't know, maybe 5 years, something like that.
Okay. So I guess one question again about this, looks like about the first decade or so mm-hmm. from these first two grants.
Right.
How do you feel you balanced work life and home life?
Oh, it was easy, being half time. And I would work, of course, more than 20 hours a week, but it was really nice. It was a really nice life, you know, going to work, being intellectually challenged. I've never been bored in all the time that I worked there. I was never bored. The people that I worked with were fine people, but certainly there were challenges over the years. But in general, family medicine is a wonderful place to work. And so the stresses of work, you know, were getting things done on time, but, you know, I didn't feel like I had to carry it home and, you know, work incredible amounts more than I was paid, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, Peter being a teacher, our lifestyle in the summer was quite nice, too. You know, it was just really, it was a nice way to have a family and have our kids grow up and be able to spend more time with them.
Mary Beth, is there anything on your mind about trying to do this chronologically, if, mm-hmm. if you couldn't tell here, about yeah. this sort of the first decade or so of your time through these first two grants? Anything else on your mind that you want to make sure you get on the record?
I can't think of anything. You know, the thing that does come to mind about work-life balance was it also gave me a chance working half-time to be more active in my kids' schools. So I would spend time in the schools. I ran the computer lab at Mendota School and the kids were there because they didn't have a teacher who could do it. Mm-hmm. And then when we moved over here, I wasn't as active at Glen Stevens, but but my daughter was in Jefferson Middle School the next year, and I became very active over there in terms of the Jefferson Follies and worked on it as a producer for 5 of the 6 years my kids were there.
Okay.
And could never have done that if I'd been working full-time.
Right.
So it was great, you know, it was great community building. It was a wonderful thing to meet people and, you know, be part of my kids, make my kids' education be even more rich.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mary Beth, I want to thank you for your time today.
Sure.
I appreciate it.